Jerry.
Lois.
Daryl.
Kevin.
And welcome back, Ruth. It's been a long time. Glad to have you. And Anne, it's nice to have you this year. It's a full house. Okay, so Saturday is our day long, 9:30 to 3:30, with instructions and silent lunch. So I hope many of you can come and support the people from the intro class that will be coming. And 2 weeks from tonight will be our Day of the Dead celebration. So if you'd like to bring something in remembrance of someone who has died, a picture or a memento or a poem or a flower, whatever you'd like, that would be great. I think I'll bring a big vase, and then maybe some of us, several of us, can bring marigolds. So we'll have a true ofrenda. Unfortunately, Michelle won't be able to be with us this year. Yeah, we'll miss you, Michelle. But we'll carry on. And speaking of that, do you want to announce, Michelle, the play?
I announced it last night. Some of us are going tomorrow night to see De Partera, which is a play at done by Teatro Vision at the Mexican Heritage Plaza. And if you know Jaime, who comes occasionally, and his wife also comes, his wife is Luisa Marina Maldonado, and she is Alvarado, sorry. And she's directing the play. And if you were here with us for our celebration last year, she spoke a little bit about how we have midwives to bring people into the world, but we don't often have people to help us leave the world. And so she was looking into the whole idea of having someone like as a doula, as a midwife, to do the same for people who are passing away. So she talked a little bit about that last year, and so this play kind of centers around that, someone who helps people move on to the other world. And it was a play that was created with community input. They had people telling stories of their loss, and it also, they had song circles, so it sounds like it's pretty interesting. So anyways, it's this weekend, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday afternoon, and Kevin and I are going tomorrow. So if anybody wants to join us, you can let me know, or I can get you more information on the play.
Dinner at 6:30. Mexican food. anybody else?
Just to remind people, if you have any clothing, any ages, any type, especially warm clothing now that the winter is coming, blankets are even welcome. We take them to the Sacred Heart Community Center downtown for the homeless and low income. If you have it, bring it to Sandra. And if I'm not here, Anne said she would be glad to take it. And if neither of us is here, I hope Forget will hold it, and I'll come and pick it up.
Well, I can take it up there.
I can take it up.
Or Michelle said she can pick it up also. From the sun. Thank you very much.
Okay. Well, welcome, Angie.
Thank you very much.
It's been a little while. We're happy to have you. Most all of you, I think, know Angie. If anybody doesn't, Angie leads the Floating Zendo group on Tuesday night here and has been a regular teacher with us for a long time. So we're happy to have you.
Thank you. Good evening. It has been a long time. Remarkable. I've been doing a very odd thing. At least to me, it feels very odd still. I have been going through many, many of the talks that I've given through the years and editing them and preparing them for a book. And when I first began, I was horrified. I just could not imagine that these awkward words could possibly be published in public view. that would be too embarrassed. As the months have gone by, I have changed my mind about it, of course. It's become a very interesting kind of remembering all the different talks in the different places that over the years, and it has been many years, that I've been meeting with you all and with Gil's group and IMC, wherever it happened to be, which was a lot of different places through the years, and our own group, either in retreat or in this little room. So it's given me a lot of thought about teaching, because it's supposed to be about somebody's teaching. That was the idea. Francis Carney, Ado Carney, has a publishing company now where she publishes books from women's perspective. She's published 3 or 4 already now that are very wonderful talks by various, mostly Zen students, I think, so-called teachers. But she's reaching out more and more, and she hauled me in for one of them also. And it's given me a lot of thought about what it is to teach. And I think it's a mistaken word. We call it a teacher, but it's not like first grade. You don't come to learn something, and you don't come to paste information into people's psyche. It's a different kind of encounter. Really good first grade teachers, of course, do this kind of encounter, which means that they're really just allowing the people that they're with, which in the first grade are quite small people, to discover themselves, to connect with themselves. And the better the teacher, the more deeply they can do that. And I think we all remember the best teachers we ever had did that, gave ourselves back to ourselves in ways that otherwise just doesn't happen. There's a lot of learning and a lot of knowledge that is available to us all the time now, especially. It just keeps pouring out of every glass-based object. But it's not the same as giving something back. In my years of doing this, I feel like I've been more of a student than ever. All these years, it becomes, once you have to open your mouth and say something, you really have to study. You really have to feel like you're letting yourself go so that something can come through. And the coming through part is what's shared as we meet together. so that there isn't really a self of a teacher or a self of a student. It's all happening in the space between us all. It's a very wonderful experience to find ourselves in this place. When I walked in, and I was a little bit late because of the traffic tonight, it was such a beautiful sight. Y'all just looked wonderful. This nice row of beings, and this nice row of beings, and everyone was so quiet. And obviously, something was happening. And yet we don't have a name for it. It's just an occasion, an amazing occasion that we gift ourselves with every Wednesday night. Isn't that amazing? I just marvel. And having done this for 40 years now, I just can hardly imagine that it goes on and on. And when we're gone, it will still be going on. My teacher always says there's no end to the Dharma. The Dharma continues no matter what. And it certainly does feel that way. And yet, in a way, it's our job, each one of us as students, to find ways of expressing the truth of our life, the truth that we see and experience and can share. One of our precepts is not withholding the teachings. And it doesn't mean we should go out and start preaching on the sidewalk. In fact, it's the opposite of that. That's very annoying. You collar somebody and listen to this. But our own life itself is the Dharma, is the life of the Dharma. And each one of us is totally different from each other. That's the marvel of it. Sometimes we try, especially when we're young, to kind of fit in and be like everybody else. And it never works because we're not. And the more that we practice, the more we become who we are. I often think we kind of get boiled down like a good sauce. You know, you have to keep stirring it a bit and it gets more and more delicious as it cooks down. You don't want it too hot, but it's really good. So that we don't have to know that about ourselves so much. We can just freely be that. And I think as we continue in practice, we do feel more free to be whatever this is. Truth is, it's very hard to even begin to understand what this is. I mean, we think we know. We get out of bed and say, I, me, mine. It's my house and my time and my world and my life and all of those things, but if we really explore that, it's very hard to know what that is. We look in the mirror and we see not ourselves, but another image. It's another image. It's not anything that we would ever see. We don't know what other people see when they look at us. We can't. And so, in a way, it's an encouragement just to stop being self-conscious and drop the whole sense of ourself and just be what it is. Because that itself is the Dharma. That we ourselves are the truth of our life. And the more we share it, the more help we can be in the world, the more we can influence in a good way what needs, really hungers for this kind of knowledge. There's the head kind of knowledge, all the information that we have. And then there's the belly kind of knowledge, the kind that we don't even really quite know we know until we say it. If you keep a journal, it's a great practice because you write and then you look at it and it shines back at you and tells you what you think. Oh, that's what I think. So it's very excellent practice to find ways of just saying our truth as we can, as honestly as we can, as clumsily as we can, as foolishly as we feel we are. Because often our foolishness is our greatest wisdom. It's so easy to try to be better than we are and feel ashamed because we're not. And the truth is, we are better than we think. So it's all a waste of time and effort. So, learning about for myself all this way of speaking and listening, I begin to realize how closely sitting in this place I'm speaking to everyone. Sometimes people will come up to me afterwards and say, "You must have known what I was thinking." And I never do. But we're all sharing the same vibration, you could say. And so it does happen that way. And it happens for each one of you, wherever you are, that you're sharing the vibration of the people that you're with. And it can be a great gift to them. So I encourage you to open yourself up to your Dharma and not consider yourself a teacher, because I think that doesn't belong to any of this business that we're in, but as a student. A sincere student who can share this experience. All through the years, I met so many wonderful people. At IMC, once my own doctor showed up. I couldn't believe it. And people asked the most wonderful questions. And reading back through all of that, I learned so much all over again. Where people were coming from, how people were suffering, and how they were trying to work with it and work together with it. At IMC, we had some wonderful experiences. There was the time when the beautiful Mahaprajapati statue that is there was born, and Gil wanted it to be introduced to the Sangha. So he invited everybody to come, and men and women met in one room together first with some kind of conversation, and then the women were sent in with Mahaprajapati, and the men were left by themselves to talk. And so the women then started raving, I want to say, about how unfair it was that Buddha turned her down when she wanted to be ordained and be one of his students. And she had all her people around her who also wanted ordination. And mostly it was young women, and they just felt it was unconscionable that how could Buddha do that. And so we had very intense conversation. And then the men came in and joined us for cake and a kind of celebration. It was a very curious encounter. And that kind of discussion continues. How can that be? And there are all kinds of good reasons for it, actually. It was a very dangerous life in India. It still is, especially for a woman. And so any kind man would want to protect the women. And I think that's what his intention was. Finally, Ananda talked him into it. He said, "Oh, come on, Buddha." He said, didn't you say that all beings can be enlightened?" And Buddha said, "Well, yeah, I did say that." And so Ananda said, "You've got to do this. This is your mother, your stepmother. You've got to do this." So he did it. In the monastery for women in Japan, they don't celebrate Buddha's birthday. They celebrate Ananda's.
When is it?
I don't know. We'll have to find out.
Yes. That's what I was thinking. We might start a celebration.
Yes, we should do that. We should do that. And there was a time when Gil asked me to be Mahabhadrapati and die in front of everybody. Maybe some of you saw that. That was quite remarkable. So, besides Dharma talks, there were other kinds of teaching, I guess you could say. And I told a lot of Jikoji stories, and I've come to think as I read through all this material that the Jikoji stories are really important too. That the way that we live our actual life, the dilemmas that we get caught up in, the people that we get to know that we never would have imagined to know, the way we solve our problems when they come up, all of that is a part of how we practice and how we learn to practice as occasions come up. There isn't any rule, any law. There isn't any strict place that tells us how to be with each situation. It means that we respond from our heart and our belly to each situation as a teaching situation. That this is our teacher, whatever is in front of us, and we are its teacher too. We are its student and they are our student, and it works both ways for every situation. So at Jikoji, when we were talking to ex-convicts and drug addicts and really complicated and difficult people, we had a choice of meeting them rigidly according to the rules and the regulations of society, or meeting them in terms of the Dharma. And our teacher, without saying a word, just did that. just met them heart to heart. And instead of laying on a teaching, he would just demonstrate, you could say, by his life. I remember once we were sitting on a porch, and a whole bunch of the folks that who had kind of taken over, and some of the Zen folks were all sitting together, and the some of the people started complaining, just grouchy about, oh, it's so dirty, you know, it's so messy around here, it's horrible, look, there are cigarette butts and beer cans and all this crap all over the place, this is terrible, complaining to us because we were the owners. And Koban just leaned down and started picking up everything bit by bit and shamed everybody into doing it too. And that was a very simple example. We invited everybody in to sit with us, and some of them came. In the early years here, there were a lot of homeless people living on the other side of the fence on top of the freeway, and they would want to come in, and so I invited them in because my teacher did that at Jikoji. And it shocked everybody. We're all nice suburban people. And it was a very startling thing, but it was very nice. And they were glad to come in. Not everybody, but a few. And that too was a teaching without saying a word, really. Just please, please come. Sometimes I think practice gets to be so such a small world. It is for me, it's becoming a small world for me because I'm not doing nearly as much anymore. I'm not flying to Austria anymore, or even sitting retreats anymore. So it's becoming more and more narrow. And I am very encouraged every time I hear you all collecting blankets and clothes and doing the things that need to be done, reaching out and opening up the practice as much as possible. It's why we're doing this, actually. We're not doing really for our own benefit. Kodo Sawaki, one of Koban's strangest teachers in Japan, when he was asked about meditation, he just said, it's good for nothing. So he was pointing to something very important, actually. No gaining idea, you could say, or no attachment. So it's about that too, our practice. No attaching to our practice even, but just opening it up as much as we can. So that's what I brought tonight. And there's time for questions.
Angie, I'm just curious where the people came from that were at Jikoji.
They were from everywhere. They were, it was in that time, in the 70s, when there were Vietnam vets, there were runaway kids, mm-hmm. There was a runaway nun. there were a couple of ex-cons. There were just some drifters. And they had made at the top of Page Mill a little village and built little houses. You remember that?
I remember hearing about it.
Yes.
From you a long time ago.
Yes, right along the creek, across the street from where the fault line, the little fault line park is. And they thought they owned it. Somebody told them that they could have the property. So they did. They were very happy up there and had some kind of community. And then Open Space came along and said, sorry, but we own this. And so they called the sheriff and kicked him out. They just bulldozed down all their houses, and they suddenly were homeless. But at the same time, Pacific High School, just down the street, was in trouble because they had been misusing their funds and not telling the IRS about it. And so they had to sell. And they had to sell to a nonprofit. And that's how we got to buy Pacific High School. So they just went trucking on down there and moved in. There were all these geodesic domes all built up through the woods. Yes. Buckminster Fuller had been at the school and had built all these domes for the kids to live in. And it was a scene. It was quite a scene. The neighbors used to come after they'd moved and drive through and say, where are the naked people? You know, because there used to be a lot of naked people there. They loved. So all these folks ended up there. And they were very angry because they had started out angry and they were rejects, and then they had made a world and then they got pitched out of it. So they were in bad shape. And so we tried very hard not to make it any harder for them than we had to. Eventually we had to sell, or we thought we had to sell, and we put the thing for sale, and then we had to evict everybody, but we found places for people to live. And so it worked out. And then we got to keep most of it. So that's how they got there. They said, you know, you don't own it. You don't own this property. Only God owns the land. We thought, well, you know, you're right. You know? But on the other hand, somebody has to take care of it, and there are all these beer cans and cigarette butts all over the place. So.
Quite a story. Maybe you should write a book about that one.
I think about that sometimes. Yeah.
A lot of things in that story, yeah.
Many stories from there.
I have a question. So, as you're writing the book about your speeches through time, how do you see? Do you see any differences? I mean, the Dharma, I assume, is the same through time, our time beyond. But do you see through your time, do you see differences on how we as people are 40 years from now, on how we're interacting with the Dharma, with the teaching?
You know, it's
like
hard.
Like time changes?
Yeah. It's hard to say because I've changed. Mm. When I began, I was terrified. It's a very scary thing. And I wrote all my talks out very carefully. I labored over it. I anguished over every single word. And I think they were very boring talks. I haven't listened to those ones. You can just imagine. Blah, 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 blah. So I'm looking through from, I think 2000 are the oldest ones, and they're all just about the same as the ones I'm doing now. Mm-hmm. And they're pretty much off the cuff on a subject, but not in any kind of straightforward way, you could say. There was a time when I was on opiates, and I thought that would have made a difference in the talks, but I can't see any difference in the talks, even though I had fentanyl patches on my arm, and I had a doctor who wanted to kill my pain, and he was very kind about it and just kept lavishing all this stuff. And looking back, I just can't imagine that I was even coherent. But apparently, at least in the space I could speak, it comes from somewhere else. So, in fact, we have training for that. We're actually have questions fired at us at a certain point in a ceremony, and then you have to just bring it up, just like that. And you learn that it's not you. Yeah, it's a good question.
Teaching a lot longer than that.
Well, we have tons and tons of tapes, or they took the tapes and put them online.
So recorded ones.
Recorded ones. Uh-huh. And we've got earlier ones than that, but the students chose them. Mm-hmm. I've had little to do with the technical side of this book. Thank goodness. I don't know how they chose the things that they chose. Well, they were choosing subjects. So there's a chapter on the precepts. There's a chapter on the paramitas. There's a chapter on Buddha's life, and etc. It's really the Dharma as we know it, coming from one particular direction. So they just sussed it out somehow. Yeah. Anything else?
I have a question for you, and it's a really sort of personal question about the work that I'm doing in the jail. Mm-hmm. And as it happens, I have begun to do one-on-one visits with men on the men's side. Oh. And so, I've joined the chaplaincy program, so at the moment I'm the designated Buddhist chaplain. Mm-hmm. I would say by now 100% of the men that I've dealt with have some kind of mental issues. And so I can't fix anything. I can't talk Dharma the way I would talk Dharma to someone who has a lot of, or even a little experience with it. I'm puzzling how to be present with that. And I'll just give you an example. Today I saw a man, and I'm going to use inmate speak, who said, my mind is so fucked up. And he was sad about that.
Yeah.
And I think it was a very good insight.
Yes.
I think that's exactly his experience of life. He said, it's never going to be different, and I'm all fucked up.
Yeah.
And I couldn't think of anything to say back, and we sat in silence with that for a long time. And I didn't know if he was, he wasn't weepy, but he was just very sad. And, you know, I just wanted to do this.
Yes.
I didn't. I sat there and just tried to hold that. Anyway, you know, being with people who do have these really difficult obstacles in their mind that probably aren't going to get better for various reasons, that's a whole different place to be.
Yeah.
And yet I feel very responsible to be a good presence in their life and not try to fix what can't be fixed.
Yeah.
And I don't even know what question I'm asking. This just sort of happened this afternoon with this particular one. Others talk. Lots of verbiage.
Yeah.
And the head chaplain said you have to listen under all the words
mm-hmm.
to figure out what they really are trying to deal with.
Yeah.
It's such a different way to be.
Yes.
Than anything I've done before.
Yes.
I have to say, I find it very stimulating and challenging.
Yes.
And
heartbreaking.
I'm not always sure I'm doing a very good job.
Yes.
With it.
Yes.
But I would like at least to do no harm. And I'm not sure how to do that.
Well,
I'm doing the best I can. And it was really encouraging for me to hear you say we're probably doing better than we think we're doing.
Yes.
You know, I thought, oh, I really need to do that. Because, you know, it's hard to be with someone with conditions in their life that are not going to be different
yes.
for them or that are going to be just as hard in some other way.
Yes.
This guy will get released. He said, I'll go back out there. I'll hang out with the same stupid people and I'll be back in here.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that, I think he had good insight into
mm-hmm.
how things are.
Yeah.
And I can't say, oh, there, everything will be fine. I don't
know. No, you know he's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that. So, anyway, I'm trying to figure out how to be a Buddha in the midst of that kind of input to me. And it was helpful to hear you say, he's my teacher.
Yes.
I hadn't thought of it that way this afternoon when this happened. And if I can bring that to mind, then we will meet in that space between us,
yes.
not here and not there.
Yes, exactly.
So this has been really helpful for me to hear what you said tonight. Thank you.
And I think the silence that you offered to him today was very, very helpful. That's sometimes the only thing you can do.
Yeah.
And that already is a huge present to give to somebody. Because he's feeling it the whole time. He's feeling your presence and the quiet that surrounds the two of you. I mean, that all by itself is enough. Yeah. That's a big job, Margaret.
It is. I'm really tired after I do that.
I bet you are.
Yeah.
Oh, thank
but
you.
I
thank
like
you for
it.
Doing it.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you very much. Well, that's a great note to end on. Thank you. Thank you all.
Thank you. Ruth, are you up for leaving this? I'm all about. I can't quite do this, but it's better than mine.
Oh.
May I be happy. May I be free from suffering.
Yeah. Thank you.